Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Felicitations, I'm Nate Langson, and this text message was sent on the 18th of January, 2015. We're peering inside the kimono of news first with Top of the Pods to discover the top 10 technology stories scrolled across our information geisha affecting you and the UK this week. In at number 10, and written by Matthew Sparks on The Telegraph, the Spectrum ZX is making a comeback of sorts with the launch of a new device called the Vega, which allows you to play 14,000 games created for the iconic computer on a normal television. The Sinclair Spectrum Vega is described as a recreation of the 1980s personal computer, but designers have been able to condense all electronics from the original machine into a tiny amount of modern hardware. Externally, it looks similar to the ZX, but is much smaller, no surprise there, without a full keyboard and is handheld. It also incorporates Bluetooth, so can be used as a remote games controller for other machines. It's been created by Luton-based company Retro Computers, which Sir Clive Sinclair, the designer of the ZX, is a shareholder in. At number 9, and written by James Temperton on Wired.co.uk, the head of Vodafone in the UK has said that reliability, not speed, is the most important issue for 4G networks. Jeroen Hernkamp claimed that high-speed data on mobile only gets you so far, and that most people didn't even know what 4G was. In a thinly veiled slight at rival network EE, Hernkamp also said that the best 4G network for customers wasn't about who's got the most coverage. Vodafone's fledgling network currently covers 50% of the UK, with EE claiming over 80%. He continues, "It's more about having the strongest signal. We'd love to expand the network faster, but it's about doing it right the first time. I'd rather do it at the pace we're doing it and get it right, rather than go faster and build a thin and flimsy network," he said. Fighting words. At number 8, by Keith Stewart on The Guardian, a useful roundup of the top games from 2014. The best-selling games of 2014 were revealed in the UK and US, and no one's really surprised that brands like Grand Theft Auto 5, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, and FIFA 15 dominated the year in the charts. In the UK, figures provided by the chart track show that FIFA 15 was the biggest seller of the year. The long-running football sim series sold 2.66 million copies in the UK in 2014, according to the Entertainment Retailers Association, with Call of Duty Advanced Warfare coming in at 1.84 million. There are no really big hitters that will come as a surprise in the top 10, which from 1 to 10 are FIFA 15, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, Grand Theft Auto 5, Destiny, Watch Dogs, Minecraft for Xbox, FIFA 14, Far Cry 4, Call of Duty Ghosts, Assassin's Creed Unity, basically sequels and blockbuster rehashes of previous games. In at number 7, by a nameless writer on the BBC, Google is ending sales of its Glass eyewear. The company insists it's still committed to launching the smart glasses as a consumer product, but will stop producing Glass in its present form. Instead, it will focus more on, quote, future versions of Glass, with work carried out by a different division in Google than before. Now, the Explorer program gave software developers the chance to buy Glass for a bargain £1,000 or thereabouts, and that's going to close. From next week, the search firm will stop taking orders for the product, but says it will continue to support companies that are already using Glass. At number 6, by Catherine Hsu on TechCrunch, Samsung has hired Lee Don Tai as its new global design team leader. But what's especially noteworthy about Lee's appointment, says TechCrunch, is that he is the former co-president of Tangerine, not the fruit, but the London design consulting company where Johnny Ive worked for before joining Apple, again, not the fruit. Ive is, of course, the senior vice president of design at Apple and joined in 1992 and has since then spearheaded industrial design for almost all of Apple's devices, in addition to now overseeing the look of its software. At number 5, by another nameless person from the BBC's news desk, the UK and the US are to carry out wargame cyber attacks on each other as part of a new joint defence against online criminals. The first exercise, a staged attack on the financial sector no less, will take place later this year, Downing Street has confirmed. It's called unprecedented, this arrangement, and is between the two countries, announced by Prime Minister David Cameron ahead of talks with US President Barack Obama. In at number 4, and written by Kate Kelland on Reuters, Britain's Beagle 2 spacecraft, once dubbed a heroic failure by the nation's astronomer Royal Martin Rees, was rebranded a great success on Friday for being found on Mars 11 years after going missing. Beagle 2, part of the European Space Agency's Mars Express mission, searching for extraterrestrial life, had been due to land on Mars on Christmas Day 2003, but disappeared a few days earlier on December 19th. Until now, nothing had been heard from it. But at a packed news conference at London's Royal Society Scientific Institution on Friday, space experts said that the tiny Mars lander had been found on the surface of the red planet. Beagle 2 is no longer lost, said David Parker, chief executive of the UK Space Agency. He said that recent images from the high-rise camera on NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter showed good evidence that the spacecraft landed on Mars on the date it was due, December 25th, 2003, but had only been partially deployed. At number 3, by Roland Moore Collier on V3, a teenager has been arrested in Merseyside following a UK and FBI joint operation relating to the attacks on PlayStation and Xbox systems in December 2014. The South East Regional Organised Crime Unit revealed that an 18-year-old man was detained on the 16th of January in Southport, near Liverpool, on suspicion of accessing computer material without authorisation. Further charges include intent to committing further hacking offences, threats to kill, and providing false information online to US law enforcement, suggesting that a threat exists which requires the intervention of armed tactical units. It isn't clear whether the arrest is directly related to the Lizard Squad attacks on Christmas Day, which left many Xbox and PlayStation users unable to play games that required access to the company's servers. At number 2, by Ashley Vance on Bloomberg Businessweek, Elon Musk of Tesla Motors, SpaceX, SolarCity, and of course the Hyperloop, is launching another project. Musk wants to build a second internet in space and one day use it to connect people on Mars to the web. The space internet venture, to which Musk hasn't given a name yet, would be hugely ambitious. Hundreds of satellites would orbit about 750 miles above the Earth, much closer than the traditional communications satellite, in orbit at altitudes around 22,000 miles. The lower satellites would make for a speedier internet service with less distance for electromagnetic signals to travel. The lag in current satellite systems makes applications like Skype, online gaming, and other cloud-based services pretty tough to use. Musk's service would, in theory, rival fiber optic cables on land, while also making the internet available to remote and poor regions that don't have access. Musk says, "Our focus is on creating a global communication system that would be larger than anything that has been talked about to date." Of course, this is going to be interesting to people working inside Google on their balloon-based Loon project that also aims to provide internet accessibility to remote areas. And taking this week's number 1 spot at top of the pods this week, Andrew Griffin on The Independent writes that David Cameron could block WhatsApp and Snapchat if he wins the next general election, as part of his plans for new surveillance powers announced in the wake of the shootings in Paris. The Prime Minister said today that he would stop the use of methods of communication that cannot be read by the security services, even if they have a warrant. But that could include popular chat and social apps that encrypt their data, such as WhatsApp. Apple's iMessage and FaceTime also encrypts their data and could fall under the ban, along with other encrypted chat apps like Telegram. Well, it's time to take off our shirts and get tickled pink as we look at this week's Sense of Rumour. KGI security analysts are back with another report outlining the belief that Apple will launch a stylus as an optional accessory for the company's rumoured 13-inch iPad Pro. With the new iPad's larger screen, it will likely prove popular with enterprise and creative users who tend to have more need for a stylus, and the researchers believe that Apple will fill that need with an in-house stylus solution. More can be read about this on Mac Rumors and other Apple blogs. And if you've got a sense of rumor of your own burrowing under your skin, langston@icloud.com is an email where you can send things to me in text form, or of course you can send an audio file if you so wish. Joining me now, first guest, well, not really a guest, first co-host, Mr. Ian Morris.
Hello, Nate.
Hello, my friend. It's... You're about to say it's lovely to be podcasting with you.
It
again.
Is. A rich history of such things, don't we?
We do. Ian and I, for the uninitiated, or for the recently born, we used to...
Are you expecting a lot of babies to be tuning into your podcast, Nate?
I have started this show with the intention of appealing to the broadest range of demographics. That does include the recently slithered into existence. Yes. Ian and I go back to the old CNET days. We did the CNET UK podcast together, which was some of the most fun podcasting I think you can have.
Yes.
Was that show. And we've sort of long since, for the last few years, said, well, we really need to podcast again. So it's rather exciting to be starting a regular show that we can do together.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't sort of, apart from to do the Wired podcast once, I haven't really stepped foot in a podcast facility for some time, many years actually.
Well, here we are in a podcast facility of sorts.
Absolutely, a virtual one.
Albeit virtual, such is the joy of technology, which is, of course, the topic of the podcast. We wanted to pick a topic and really dive into it. And one of the ones that I thought about for this week was something that came up when Ian and I were having fish finger sandwiches, I think, in a Mayfair cafe.
Having a munch.
A couple of days ago, which was to talk about the state of the television industry, both as a product, but also its supporting products, whether that's streaming media, cinema, I guess, things like that. Ian, you used to be, well, you still are a sort of television home cinema expert in a sense. Certainly were.
I don't review that stuff quite so much as I used to, although I might get back into it because I do have a real passion for home cinema.
Yeah. Well, we used to spend quite a few hours back in the CNET testing lab sort of looking at, back then, this new thing called Blu-ray that looked wonderful, and the first 1080p TV instead of the 720s, and you know why yeah. Pioneer's plasmas were just so incredibly good.
Yeah. Oh man, those were the days.
Yes. Well, you were at CES.
Yes,
and
I was.
I believe you have gone eyeballs on with these quantum dot devices from
yes.
Samsung. So do you want to give it a bit of background? What is quantum
well,
dot?
Well, yeah. So quantum dot's been around for a while. In fact, notably, Amazon uses quantum dots on its Kindle Fire tablets. Sony's had it for a while under a brand called Triluminous. And now LG has done the same thing and has gone with the name quantum dots, which is
Samsung, I think you mean.
No, Samsung's calling it SUHD, I believe.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yes. And so it is. Well. Okay, so they won't obviously say that they're staying away from the whole quantum dot naming thing. So they won't actually admit that it is, but we believe that it is. But LG has gone with the more honest naming of, as quantum dot. Now, I've spoken to people from Samsung and I've spoken to people from Sony, and both of them are sort of like, why is our technology, which has been around, or particularly in Sony's case, why is our technology, which has been around longer, not got any of this marketing traction that the quantum dot seems to have done? And I said, well, because quantum dot's been used before, Amazon did it, people kind of like the name, even though it isn't really quantum anything at all. It kind of has that exciting sound that gives people a brand. And unfortunately, if everyone's naming their thing different things, then you don't get that, do you? So that's it in a nutshell. You're going to ask me to explain what it is, aren't you? And I'm going to come unstuck gloriously.
Not necessarily. I was actually going to go with sort of suggesting why such a thing exists at all. I mean, essentially, from my understanding of what came out of CES, is that this is sort of a way of extending the lifespan of LCD, possibly because it's not possible to produce enough OLED panels, like the ones that are being used by Sony in particular and LG. And this is kind of a way of saying, well, you can't either afford the OLED version, or we can't make enough to sell them in enough volume to make them cheaper for you. So we're going to sort of take the long-established technology of LCD and sort of add effectively an additional element to each one of the liquid crystals themselves to sort of give each of those little pixels a bit more depth, a bit more clarity, and then package that as a new product that'll kind of become the stopgap between you having an old LCD and the future OLEDs that don't yet exist. That's
Absolutely. My
current understanding of what this is.
You've nailed it, essentially, yes. OLEDs are impossible to produce in volume, apparently. Only LG's managing it. So you can buy an OLED, and it probably will be an LG if you're going to do that. But again, and they're still pretty expensive. But obviously that technology is still unproven. As good as they might look on first glance, it's yet to be seen how they'll age and, you know, what exactly the future holds. But I think there's still a general pretty, you know, excitement about OLED. And you're right. It's all about giving LCD a bit more contrast, which has always been its weak spot, really. And quantum dots do that.
I remember you always raved about, I think particularly the Pioneers and the Panasonic plasmas over the last few years, and I know that it was something of a shame when they stopped producing those, because the black levels and the detail that they had, they were more than just a marketing gimmick. I mean, I always thought plasma sounded better, but you only had to look at a plasma TV displaying a Blu-ray, and you were there was no doubt in anybody's minds that this was an exciting technology that you wanted in your home. The problem that I see now, just to move things forward a little bit, is that we're sort of in this kind of era where 3D, while still technically on sale, has sort of all but been declared a failure.
It's dead, of course,
we have been saying for many...
Since it launched,
that people don't really want this. And the applications for which it is really useful, and I have to say, despite not being a sports fan or a football fan in any at all, the only time I've genuinely thought 3D added something was when I watched a football game in 3D, because I just found this small amount of depth that it gave to the pitch, where the players were and the position of the ball, and just really did mean something. Not obviously enough for me to buy one, because I'm not in the least bit interested in watching football generally, but it did amaze me that that was one of the things. And that is something you do see advertised, at least in pubs, you know, Sky Sports 3D here and all this sort of thing. So
I suspect it's not going anywhere. I just don't think there's any sort of real excitement about it anymore. I think because it doesn't cost anything to build that technology into TVs, it's just going to be there. And we won't use it, but that's fine.
We won't, but it does require glasses still.
It does.
And I still haven't yet seen a convincing glasses-free 3D. The only one that's truly mainstream at this point is the 3DS, the Nintendo.
Yeah.
And even there, while it is technically a mainstream product, I think it can be said that the 3DS is very, very successful, probably the most successful 3D product, consumer product at the moment. It's going nowhere for TV. So we're talking about 4K now, and 4K does look great.
Yeah. Yeah, 4K is genuinely exciting. I mean, it's a boost, and resolution is something that gives you a very noticeable improvement, especially on bigger screens. So, you know, a few years ago, and I've talked to Samsung about this. I have semi regular chats with their UK president, Andy Griffiths. He's a really nice guy and very interesting to talk to. And he was telling me that, you know, a few years ago the average size was 37 inch, and now they're just shifting phenomenal numbers of 50 and 60 inch screens, because people have just realised that even though you think you might not have room for one, actually you probably do. And there's no reason not to have a big screen, even if you sit close to it. It's still, especially with 4K, you're still getting a really nice picture.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, with the 4K as well, it seems to me to allow greater levels of creativity when it's on the PC side. I've, at the moment, got a 4K monitor that I've been using to test a very high-end gaming system, and that's fantastic. But the advantage to creating content in 4K means you can crop into the picture a lot more, which gives you much more control over framing and this sort of stuff, which could serve a benefit. The problem is, in the UK at the moment, 4K TVs are still extremely expensive, and B, some of the best, easiest, and most affordable way to get 4K content, ironically, is to make it yourself.
Yes. I mean, there isn't a lot of 4K content. No, I mean, not many people are shooting it. It's, I suppose, really, 4K is going to be an interesting one, because it's not... one of the things about film is it's possible to do a scan of film at 4K, and it's probably possible to do a scan of film at 8K, but I think you're going to start to see diminishing returns on it. So really, until we've got, you know, video camera, you know, CMOS sensors that are shooting at 8K, I think that we've probably reached the sort of limit of what film can deliver in resolution terms. I might be wrong about that, because there's always been a bit, you know, people have always said that film is kind of, because it's an analog medium, you can probably always get more detail out of it. But, you know, 4K is genuinely exciting. And, look, you know, you can make it on your phone now. And that's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Yeah. But that's funny that you say that, that to hear film talked about as a technology that is close to reaching its peak of usefulness as far as advancing picture quality goes is amazing, because film has always been this gift that keeps on giving. You know, the only reason that we can have, you know, the Blu-ray versions of films made in 1960 is because film is there and lets us do this. But I mean, I've got 8K on my list of things to raise as an issue, because I've seen an 8K television. It was made by Sharp, I think. I saw it for the first time about 3 years ago, and it was on display at either CES or IFA, I think. And it was just kind of one of the Japanese NHK programs. They'd recorded, you know, steam trains pulling out of a station, all the stock footage that generally at these trade shows burns everybody's retina, you know, from their ballish,
terrible tests housing of TVs, really, because they're very unchallenging material. But
yeah, and I was asking one of the demo people at the time, kind of, what's the market for this? And, you know, do we really need this? I'm currently writing about why people shouldn't buy 3D and that 4K is probably the next thing in tech. And they were saying, like, this is not technology where, you know, there's going to be in people's homes. It just isn't, not like this. They were talking about it being for either corporate usage or for outdoor events. Basically, in other words, content that is being, that is bespoke almost to those screens, to the places the screens are going to be used. So you're not necessarily, they're not necessarily building these 8K screens for people to watch films in 8K. They're building them so that people or filmmakers or something can say, well, I know that I'm going to screen this in 8K, or I know that I'm going to have an event at which 8K could be shown, so I'm going to make content specifically for it. And I thought that's a really interesting trend, because it's sort of, if that pans out to be the case and we just sort of slice off film, it's sort of, we're sort of moving into this era where we're saying, okay, well, we're just flat out, film's done now. And still today, a lot of stuff is being shot on film. A lot of it's on digital and on, you know, Reds and the Epics and things.
You know, Steven Spielberg, as a rule, won't shoot on digital. He will only shoot on film.
But he's been around for a while, and with the greatest of respects, his skill has traditionally been involving film.
Yes, but I don't think that the skill of a director is about the medium they shoot on. I mean, obviously there are elements to that. You know, like, for example, Peter Jackson got widely criticised for opting for high frame rate for The Hobbit, didn't he?
Yes, but that was probably only a disappointment, because it was the wrong type of film to do. If that sort of a technology used for a documentary could be fantastic. But no, it made everything look like a very, very expensive pantomime on the world's most elaborate set.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's just, you know, the problem is that we're never going to not feel like that, because we've grown up with film, and that's always going to be true of the people who are our age or older or even younger, because there are plenty of people younger. But, you know, it's I kind of feel like we're missing out on, and I get quite angry about this, because what film has some real shortcomings, and one of them is the frame rate. 24 frames a second is just not enough. I mean, you're a gamer, you know that, right?
Yeah, and all my games have to be at 60 frames a second. But that said, there is sometimes the frame rate of a film can mask certain elements of reality, and it kind of makes things feel a little bit more, I don't want to say cinematic, because I hate using that word, but there is, it's sort of like if you shoot a home video on a phone or on a home camera, generally speaking, the default is 30 frames a second. It gives everything that very home video, British sitcom type quality. If you drop that frame rate down to 24 frames a second, and some old video cameras, some of them probably still do, give an option of, you know, film mode, it's basically they just captured at 24 frames a second. Suddenly, your own home video feels more cinematic and theatrical. And that can be quite interesting as a creative choice. And by the way, what I wanted to say about the directors, not so much that they can't adapt to digital, it's more that they may have a signature look or a style to their film that they just want to continue making.
Sure.
Like some directors continued to make in black and white for a long time. Well, Stanley Kubrick, I think, was the last director to make a film in the 4:3 aspect ratio.
Ah, Stanley Kubrick's an interesting one with 4:3. He never wanted his films to be shown on TV widescreen, but that was back when we didn't really have a lot of widescreen TVs, and that carried over a little bit. I remember just around the time he died, I think there were a lot of his films were released on DVD, but they were 4:3 because that was the stipulation of all of his dealings with the film studios, was that anything home cinema related had to be 4:3. And I think eventually once he was dead, I think they were able to rescind that, and they have now put out the widescreen ones. But his argument was always that unless it was displayed on a widescreen television, you know, or something like a cinema screen, then he wanted it to go back to being the 4:3 matte, which is how he shot them to be matte ready, so there's more height. And you know, that was his thing. And I was always very disappointed because Eyes Wide Shut, it's a film I always quite enjoyed. It's a bit of a strange film, but it's rescued by the fact that Stanley Kubrick is just amazing. And I always wanted to have that in widescreen because it's got some beautiful shots in it that I think really work better in widescreen. You couldn't own it.
Just to sort of summarize, really, this year I wanted to sort of try and answer a question and give people something to take away. I mean, this year, is this the year? Is this the year 3D is officially dead?
I think it's been dead for ages, mate, to be totally honest.
I was gonna add a caveat to that, which was, or was that 2014? Which I'm guessing is the answer. We don't have to answer these sequentially. You know, by all means, I can get to the end of the list. We can come back. It is an open format, my friend, open format. But B, will 4K, which currently feels held back by price, but also by the lack of distribution, will it get better distribution, do you think, in the UK and in Europe? I probably had a third one, but it slipped my mind. So let's just focus on B. Do you think in the UK we're going to get any sort of robust 4K delivery mechanism that'll enable 4K to become more mainstream?
I do. I think I have a feeling it's a difficult one to answer. We won't get it on Freeview. Not now, probably, to be honest, probably not ever. I don't think Freeview is really the right medium for 4K. I have a feeling that Sky will launch a product this year which is 4K for sport. They've done testing already. It's technically possible. It's not particularly difficult on satellite. There's plenty of bandwidth. Sky hasn't really released an exciting new box for a long time, and it's going to want to. It will certainly help with customer churn. It will help with getting more people onto the platform as customers. So I have a feeling that Sky will be pushing it this year. Netflix, Amazon Prime Instant Video, whatever the hell it's called this week, all are going to be offering increasing amounts of 4K, and they're all shoot. You know, Netflix shoots all of its own original series. It does two things that I think are really interesting, and I wrote about this in a Forbes column. They shoot in 4K, usually with red cameras, I believe. They also shoot in a 2:1 aspect ratio, which is how they're also shooting the new Jurassic Park film. The idea of that is it's a really nice middle point. It's the cinemas, and it's good for home display. Neither is a massive compromise, unlike 1.85:1, which isn't great on cinema screens, and 2.35:1, which isn't great on home TVs, because it obviously you get huge black bars on the top and bottom. But I would respectfully suggest that there might be another technology coming this year that might be more significant.
Ooh, this is breaking. Well, it's not breaking news, probably, but breaking opinion.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because LG announced at CES during their press conference that they were doing they were collaborating with Netflix, and the idea behind that was that they wanted to start releasing HDR. Footage, you know, shows in HDR, so high dynamic range. For those who don't know what the three letters mean, but high dynamic range has been around for ages in photography. Obviously, it done well, it can give you a lot of detail in both dark and light areas. Done badly, it looks like a joke picture. I mean, we've all seen HDR shots that have been completely overblown, and you know, it's an aesthetic thing, and some people like doing it. But done well, HDR gives you the opportunity to sort of lift out details in very bright scenes whilst keeping the detail in dark scenes. Now, if you think about how your eye looks when you're looking out at a beautiful scenery, you know, you're getting loads of detail in the sky. You can see clouds and dark blue, but you're not compromising on what you're able to see in the darker areas. You still get loads of detail. And the idea is that TV's always been really bad for that. And cameras particularly just don't have that ability. You know, you because of the way they work, you've got to choose an exposure. So you've got to either open or close the iris. And you do that based on, you know, where your thing is that you're trying to draw people's attention to. But if with digital and stuff like that, and particularly red cameras, I think, you're able to get recover a certain amount of detail either side. And that gives you the opportunity to produce images that are completely different, and it's quite hard to explain how it will look, but it will be quite subtle. You might not even realise. But the idea is that it will give you a picture that has so much more in it. And you know, those times where you're sort of squinting to see things, that could be much improved by this. Now, that's going to be a technology that I think will come along with 4K, but Netflix say they're doing it this year, which I think is really interesting. And LG will say they have a TV to support it this year.
Well, what I was going to ask is, with it being picture quality based rather than, say, image size based as with 4K or 3D, which is obviously different again, I mean, can HDR be retrofitted? I mean, do you need a new TV? Because...
Oh, yes, you do need a new TV, yeah. That's obviously a problem, yeah, because you need something that's able to display. And with a lot of what goes on with TVs, it's an interesting point, but people don't really realise it. Because like you said, we're coming to the point where we can't really do any more resolution. You know, we can keep creating more and more densely packed sensors that are able to produce really high resolution footage, but there is going to be a point where we're just not going to be able to see that in terms of it's just not going to be worthwhile. So TVs will get to a certain size and they physically won't be able to get any larger. You know, although we're happy to take a big TV, you know, when you get to 100 inches, there's not many lounges that can really go bigger than 100 inches of a TV. So what you're going to do is you're going to have to try and sort of rethink picture quality and what it means. And you know, HDR gives you the opportunity to do that. It will give you something, and it will require new hardware. But it also, we're not using the current TVs, like LCDs and OLEDs have a huge amount of ability to create color and brightness that we don't use in the broadcast spectrum. It's because broadcasting has been around a long time and it hasn't changed a huge amount. And there's a lot of extra quality to be picked out from using different parts of RGB, you know, increasing the, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So you just get a much more, it would just be a subtly much better picture. And it's one of these things, you show people them side by side and they'll really get it. But it's very difficult to explain it conceptually as why anyone would want to go for a new TV to get all these things. And of course, it won't work like that. People will just upgrade as time goes by. But I would say, like you said, resolution is not going to keep getting higher. I mean, it probably will because the technology's there. But I think it will be something that people, it won't get pushed as much. It'll be ultimately not 8K, not 16K, you know. And obviously, as compression gets better, and you know, we're already seeing huge gains in compression, aren't we? That will allow us to do 4K. We'll get there eventually, but it won't be a huge deal.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who's listening who hasn't seen HDR, the best example is to probably go to Google Images and have a look at an HDR photo, and you'll get a general idea for what HDR can look like. Usually they're overblown a little bit more than I imagine we'd see in cinema, just because they're used for single pictures. And some video cameras, some phones like the Galaxy S5, for example, will shoot video in HDR. So if you search YouTube, I think, probably for Samsung S5 HDR video, you'll probably find a bunch of clips recorded in HDR. But the problem there is that, of course, you're seeing the difference on your screen, but you haven't had to update your screen to see the difference between HDR and standard. And so I do have this giant bit of skepticism that even if it is hardware required or hardware mandated that you need a new set to view HDR content, I do wonder whether or not that is purely to sell you a new TV, or whether actually your current set is perfectly capable of displaying HDR. It's just that it's easier to sell you a new one if you say it can't.
Well, that was always like the 3D thing. You know, there was no technological advance that came with 3D particularly, apart from the ability to send, you know, to trigger glasses in sympathy with what the screen was doing. That, you know, the thing that made 3D possible was the fact that we had TVs that could routinely do 60 frames a second, and half would be left eye and half would be right eye, because most stuff is 24 or 30 frames a second. So, you know, there was no big technological leap forward that gave us 3D. It was just the ability to sync with glasses, and that wasn't a huge deal. So we were all, you know, anyone that bought an expensive 3D TV when they came out was really, well, they saw you coming, and they almost immediately sold ice to some Eskimos.
The remastering of Titanic in 3D, retrofitted to your screen, it has sunk. What I think we have adequately given to everyone listening in the United Kingdom is that this is the year that 4K becomes more accessible, and maybe it's not the worst time to buy that television set, which are getting at least a little bit more affordable, I think. This is smashing news, Ian. Once again, we have destroyed one of Earth's most complex conundrums on behalf of podcast fans everywhere.
I think this
what
is
a
amazing.
Team we make.
They're probably going to write this in a history book or something, aren't they?
Well, I'm writing it, so yes.
Oh, yeah, good idea. Well, that's the one way to control history, isn't it? To write it.
It's written by the victors and the arrogant, I've heard.
Which one are we, Nate?
Well, we're both victoriously arrogant, my friend. I think we can probably do with writing our own intro. Ian Morris can be found on Twitter at IanMorris78. I am on at Nate Langson, and your feedback is more than encouraged. Langson@iCloud.com about your view on this week's show, what you've liked, what you haven't liked. And of course, if you go to natelangson.com/podcast, you can find the show notes to this episode and of course, links to all the stories we discussed about on various publications in the top of the pod section. Until next week, this has been Text Message. I have been and will continue to be Nate Langson. Thanks for listening.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.